You're listening to episode number 91 of The Green Elephant in the Room. This is your host, Eco Rico. In our last episode, number 90, we spoke about fear. Our fear of the climate calamity and how it could be a good and motivating emotion. I'm going to paraphrase Michael Douglas's famous "Greed is good" speech in the 1987 film Wall Street. Every time I say fear, he said greed. Here we go. The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that fear, for a lack of a better word, is good. Fear is right. Fear works. Fear clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Fear in all its forms, fear for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind. My original point about fear was, you can't really let people's need for hope get in the way of telling the truth. We shouldn't view fear as paralyzing, but as a necessary response that activates people to recognize danger and take action. Given that the state of our planet is in the throes of an ecological meltdown, that increased fear is rational. It's important to feel afraid of things that will kill us. That is healthy. In researching the topic of fear as a motivational factor for eco-action, we dove deeper into human psychology as it's related to human concerns, anxieties, and dread. Now, among other things, we take another look at fear. What we found out was, even though we are living through an unprecedented climate and ecological disaster, we find it shocking that most Americans and global citizens aren't cowering in fear every day about the future of the planet. There's a psychological reason for that. For one, the climate crisis is a much lower priority for Americans than other national issues, such as the economy and healthcare cost. In our overheated presidential race this year in the U.S., the number one voting issue now is immigration at the border. According to a Yale University study, two-thirds of Americans say they are at least somewhat worried about global warming, while 30% were very worried. But because of the nature of the way many humans experience fear, connecting this emotion to something as vast and complex as a climate breakdown is difficult. The emotional response to the climate crisis, even if we feel fearful during an episode of, say, wildfire smoke or flooding, is similar to what many people who live in war zones may experience. While at first, the threat of bombs and attacks are imminent and extremely frightening, however, eventually those who remain in these areas adapt somewhat to a life in which the threat becomes just another thing to deal with daily. If they're not escalating or the nature of the threat is not changing, it is difficult to keep our fear level elevated. That is exactly what the citizens of Ukraine are experiencing now. Though the climate crisis is altering our planet rapidly on a geological time scale, on a human one, the changes are happening relatively slowly. That means that even if we see record-setting temperatures or experience our first indoor due-to-smoke days, those occurrences will become the new normal within the time span of our lives. In fact, research shows that it takes humans about 2 years to adjust to deteriorating conditions. That is not necessarily good news. Instead, humans tend to adapt to our stressors, which happen in one of two ways. When faced with a fear, for instance, there are a couple of ways we can address it: the situation or our reaction to the situation. Since global heating is not something we can deal with in the moment, and most people don't even understand it fully, we often choose to ignore it as a way to protect our emotional selves. We are really, really good at avoiding things that bother us or that we don't like. It's another form of denial, which frankly, most of us practice in one form or another. For some people, one part of the discussion that tends to come up is the concern that others aren't worrying enough. Two-thirds of Americans say they rarely or never discuss the climate crisis with family and friends. This is probably also due to how humans process and internalize fear privately. You would think the scarier it is, the more we should talk about it. In fact, it's often the reverse. It's too scary to talk about. However, there may be an ironic upside to more people experiencing the effects of the climate crisis directly, in that others who were already fearful won't feel so isolated. There is a dynamic psychological term for this. It's called trauma bonding. It allows people to form deep emotional attachment from their shared ordeal. This can make for a very positive connection for individuals to share and learn from a traumatic event. The question of whether humans are scared enough of the climate emergency might be the wrong question to ask altogether. That's because fear isn't always the best motivating factor for action. The changes we need to make as a species to address global warming are huge and logistical, so they rarely have anything to do with any one person's individual fear response. Fear appeals can be effective for things like seatbelts, bicycle helmets, and cigarette smoking, if people know what they can do to address the threat. But the huge, slow-moving, complex issue of the climate crisis doesn't have a lot of answers on the individual level. Most of us feel, and really are, pretty helpless. We, of course, shouldn't ignore the realities of our rapidly changing planet. But not absorbing every bad piece of news about it and taking steps to ease our own fears, including sharing those fears with others, are also important. After all, nothing will be addressed if everyone decides to become stressed out and anxious all the time. Our ability to eventually affect change, big or small, is directly tied to how we manage the stressors that come along with this issue. This brings up a very important eco question. Does personal tragedy shape our climate change beliefs and actions? In other words, even if you experience a transformational life episode, for example, your house burned down or was destroyed by a flood from an extreme weather event, would it increase concern or motivate action? A common assumption is that direct exposure to climate-related disasters, such as wildfires and flooding, motivates people to support policy to address climate change. Yet, new research proves that this assertion doesn't hold up in reality. Given a single extreme weather event does not necessarily reflect long-term climate change beliefs. Why? The reason is individuals often rely on their pre-existing beliefs to interpret extreme weather events in terms of the climate emergency. This means that individuals who already believe that the climate crisis is real may interpret their experiences as a confirmation of the impacts of a climate emergency. And those who are more skeptical of climate science are less likely to attribute their experiences to climate change. The wider implication is, even if you lost your house to an amped-up hurricane or lost your cattle in drought conditions, it is not necessarily going to affect attitudes and pro-environmental concerns. This would include such actions as engaging with climate change content online, voting for green political candidates, or supporting a carbon tax. Often when people have experienced severe impacts, they will say, "We don't have time to think about this now. We are too busy rebuilding our lives." And that is understandable from a psychological point of view. Climate and environmental destruction is a difficult threat for humans to cope with in a constructive manner. The problems associated with the climate crisis are abstract and large scale, and they differ from the more immediate threats that humans are adapted to respond to. The abstract and long-term characteristics of having to deal with our overheated planet can also promote psychological rationalizations for not taking action to mitigate and prepare for disasters. Thank you. Despite some growth in renewables, progress in climate change remains elusive. We have cultivated a deep dependence on fossil fuels that have been driving Earth's temperatures up for more than a century, creating a problem whose mostly negative impacts are and will be unfolding for hundreds of years. We have reached a point in human history where it doesn't matter which day we choose, there is always a climate emergency somewhere in the world. An emergency we can close our ears and eyes to. Climate deniers learn new tricks from their forefathers in the tobacco lobby to distort our thinking. Tobacco companies no longer deny smoking is bad. That battle is lost. Instead, they promote an emotional appeal about freedom and individual choice. So because the climate deniers have lost the scientific fight, instead they have chosen to fight on a different terrain. They also invoke individual choice, reformulating progress as personal freedom. It's sold as the benefits of growth and economic development bring the whole world wealth. It's a strange sell, yet a compelling one. I mean, who hasn't fantasized about being rich? It is consistent with other themes in the United States, where everyone can make their own destiny and be an individual who can think for him or herself. Pseudopsychology is used to persuade us that personal liberty and growth are everything, that the freedom to travel where we wish, to see the world as our playground, and cheap energy is our birthright. We also can comfort ourselves that massive forest fires, collapsing animal populations, and coral deaths are how natural ecosystems have always functioned, and are normal events we shouldn't worry too much about so long as we recycle. So I ask again, where is the outrage? Given that climate change is already killing people and the death toll is only set to rise, the efforts most of us make to cut back our meat consumption, drive the speed limit, or bike to work a few days a week seem like pitiful responses to a global crisis of almost unimaginable proportions. Similarly, while many of us may fire off the occasional email to a senator or turn up to a protest from time to time, you'd think that the prospect of humankind radically altering the Earth's ecosystems that it depends on for survival would merit a little more protest than just a few news articles or YouTube videos jammed in between celebrity gossip or the latest sports score or the murder mystery industrial complex. With the U.S. elections looming and with new research highlighting how we are understanding the cost of this crisis, you can't help but think about this tormented question. Why is climate change so damn easy to ignore? Why aren't we all manning the barricades, or searching for lifeboats, or sending up flares, or calling 911? This monumental issue is personal. It just doesn't feel that way. Here are three thoughts on the subject as to why. First, we just aren't programmed to absorb and act on huge amounts of data or global level threats. We act when things are brought closer to home or when they are made relevant to our daily lives. The inherent dangers of driving in heavy traffic or a threatening barking dog are right in front of you and pose an immediate threat. A slow, lumbering catastrophe that's impacting every living thing on Earth? Forget about it. Number two, we must recognize that systematic problems require systematic solutions. For all the hippie mamas and the extreme minimalists out there who are undoubtedly shifting our culture toward a less destructive paradigm, green lifestyle choices will never save us. We must bring everyone along for the ride. And number three, there are simply so many other issues that can and should command our attention. We focus on immediate problems. Climate change may be the big daddy of all crises, but we can't afford to ignore the other issues out there that we have to face. From biodiversity loss to labor rights, inequality, and human trafficking, making the world better doesn't just mean stabilizing the climate so we can keep on being mean to each other and the species we share the planet with. Here is a fundamental misunderstanding. Given that 97% of scientists agree that a climate catastrophe is unfolding in front of our eyes, why is it some still choose to ignore it? Evidence has been collected around the world and is unrefutable, yet people prefer to deny it. Why is this? A big one is temperature scale. But hey, come on, we're only talking about a couple of degrees here and there. All of us have experienced temperature fluctuations of dozens of degrees in a single day. Super cold in the morning, blistering in the afternoon. So you might be thinking, how can 0.5 degrees, a half a degree, can have such a big impact? But your body is exactly the same. Only a 0.5 degree increase is needed for a person to start developing a fever. If the planet's temperature is lower or higher than its optimal temperature, it will start showing symptoms just like we do, and ecosystems will not be able to sustain themselves. The science is overwhelmingly clear, but countries are refusing to act now to avoid future consequences. People are more concerned about the present and for themselves. Reality check. Global heating is happening now. It's not a future problem. As a society, we do not like to be confronted with challenges. We try to avoid them and hope they will go away. But this is not something that will go away magically. It's something we need to face head on. Everyone is too busy solving their current troubles. Financial difficulties, family tensions, which phone to buy next. Even though these seem unimportant compared to the climate crisis, we are still more concerned about them because they are in the presence. Here's one we probably don't give a lot of thought to. Life is too darn comfortable, too cushy. Fossil fuels have made our lives so much easier, and people are finding it hard to change and adapt to a new lifestyle. People do not want to stop using their cars as it makes their life a lot easier. People cannot stop buying plastic-containing products because they use them so much. A clear example is all of this new technology we enjoy. If you're old enough, you can clearly remember a time, 20 or 30 years ago, when all our tech wasn't so ubiquitous. It has made most of us lazy, and it now seems it would be impossible to live without these, even though it was possible in the past. Let's face it, it's easier to ignore and deny climate change if it means continuing your life as it is. The problem is too big. People believe the climate crisis is too big and that their actions will not make a difference. For the past 200 years or so, humanity has basically behaved like a drunk, entitled teenager with regard to the health of the planet, spewing trillions of tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Consequences be damned. Finally, I suspect many of us are simply overwhelmed by the scale and speed in which this whole drama is unfolding. Even those of us who try to green our lifestyles and raise a stink to the powers that be find it hard to see a path from where we are going to want to be as a species. Yes, 100% renewable energy is possible. Yes, large-scale reforestation should be pursued relentlessly. And yes, recent progress in dematerializing our economy is encouraging and exciting. But when the popular culture focuses more on keeping up with the Kardashians than keeping up with our disappearing shorelines, or obsessing over the Real Housewives of Hollywood instead of the real fires in the Hollywood Hills, It's astoundingly hard to remain focused and not be discouraged. But we argue it is not really about whether you feel optimistic or pessimistic. It's about whether you want to fight or simply accept defeat. Only then will we be able to formulate strategies that actually change minds, win hearts, and generate lasting, sustainable change. In fact, there are so many reasons why we ignore our environmental issues that it's overwhelming and beyond the scope of this podcast. We have included a lot more resources on the Green Elephant webpage for this episode. We all know what the problems are when it comes to our overheated planetary atmosphere, hydrosphere, and biosphere. The simplest definition for climate change we have found is there's either too much water or too little. You often hear we need to get everyone on board if we're going to resolve our environmental dilemma. I even said it myself in this episode. The key to taking on these staggeringly enormous issues successfully is to rally a relatively small group of impassioned and dedicated individuals to work together in the existing environmental movement that has long been established. What we are talking about is maybe 3-4% of a country's population to band and work together, which will spark the substantial societal transformation needed. While 3-4% is a small percentage point, it ends up being a considerable number of individuals. In the U.S., that would be equal to 11 million people, about the population of New York City. In the United Kingdom, with a population of 60 million people, that would be the equivalent of about 2 million people. Extensive research reveals that, time and time again, a small number of dedicated people can increase in number until they reach a critical point. At this point, their moral message and influence can explode, having a remarkable influence on the broader population. So, how's we going to do that, boss? The Green Elephant has dedicated a series of podcasts, episodes 62 through 66, about how this can be accomplished. This is not pie-in-the-sky, hippy-dippy, airy-fairy stuff. It is fact-based, scientifically evidenced, historically proven methods, processes, and techniques that have been spectacularly successful in the past and can and will work to curb the insanity. Plus, the Green Elephant has designed a comprehensive online encyclopedia of eco-solutions. A call to act, it is a well-organized, thoughtfully laid-out resource of hundreds of climate and environmental groups to join and thousands of eco-action activities to be taken. It is packed with people and organizations doing something. This is your grand opportunity to join them in our literal fight with the fearsome forces of nature that we have unleashed. Does this mean you need to make up some clever message to put on a sign and hit the streets to protest? Well, that could be a small part of it. But as mentioned, there are thousands of interesting and productive actions you can take to make a difference. Let me highlight just two from a call to act. First, citizen science. Becoming a citizen scientist is a hands-on way to track the consequences of climate and environmental change. And you don't need an advanced degree in plant biology or climate modeling to get started. The only requirements are enthusiasm, a commitment to learn, and some time in whatever chunks you can give. And with an ever-growing number of climate and ecological-related citizen science projects, it's easy to get involved, no matter whether you live in a downtown apartment or near the edge of a sprawling forest. What you will be doing is working in partnership with scientists to help gather more data from bigger geographical areas than any one person or a small team could do on their own. You can become engaged in a variety of environmental issues, such as climate change, animal migrations, and monitoring bird and plant and insect populations. It's fun and a great way to meet other like-minded people. The second one is eco-adoption programs. By supporting eco-adoption programs, you can contribute to wildlife monitoring, environmental education, stewardship, and long-term protection of the biodiversity and conservation of the natural world. You can adopt an orphaned elephant, a sea turtle, a heron's nest, an owl, an orca, a monkey, a flamingo, a pond, a tree, even an insect. These are valuable climate actions that you can take today. These are just two of the 53 invigorating sections on A Call to Act. A Call to Act is accessible on a link in the show notes.